Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. We're joined today by ETF strategist Etienne Jeancabouchard to discuss trends he and his team are seeing in the ETF space. You may know Etienne from the Fidelity ETF Exchange podcast series he co-hosts with Katrina Wilson. In today's podcast, he's speaking with host Gord Thompson, Regional VP Advisor Sales for Western Canada, and will share where he's been seeing the highest ETF flows this year and take a deep dive on opportunities in the international space. This podcast was recorded on December 8th, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Etienne, welcome.
Hi, Gord. How are you doing today?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us. Let's just take a look, a step back, though, and take a look at the ETF industry overall and how it's been performing year to date.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great place to start. What we've been seeing so far this year is actually a record year for ETFs. So obviously very happy on that front as an industry player now for Fidelity. So we actually entered the scene in 2018. So for those of you that have been following along, obviously we've been scaling up our product offerings. So some of the key trends we saw, well, I guess just with outright sales, I mentioned we're having a record year. We're close to $35 billion in positive net flows for the year, which is already way ahead of last year's, which was the $28 billion, which was a previous record as well. That being said, we have seen some divergences in terms of categories that have been more popular among investors, advisors. So this year, we actually have equities leading the way, whereas last year, fixed income had an amazing, astounding year, especially on the active fixed income side, where investors, advisors, once again, were looking for alternatives that were offering higher than benchmark yields, you know, some diversification on in terms of fixed income asset classes. So that was a very popular trend last year. But I think as we saw, you know, one of the largest drawdowns in history this year due to COVID-19, investors really looked to ETFs, for a rebalancing tool. And that's why I think equities have done so well. So in March, we actually had outflows from fixed income ETFs and then net inflows into equity mandates. So I think that was definitely one of the key trends. And I guess from a factor standpoint is where we tend to play. So smart beta products. We also did have a rotation in terms of what's been popular. So last year was the year of low volatility mandates. So, you know, products that look to have a lower beta, lower standard deviation than the broad market while staying invested 100% in equities. Now this year it's shifted quite a bit where, you know, we're looking at other types of factors like value. We're talking about quality mandates, which we'll touch a bit more on a bit later, but basically a little bit change on that front as well. The last point I will make, Gord, is that I think an emerging theme that we saw this year, not just, you know, because we're talking about it more, but on a performance and a risk standpoint, was the performance of high ESG rated stocks. And we've actually seen that flow through to the ETF sales, where the AUM and ESG ETF has close to doubled in 2020. So another emerging trend we're seeing in the industry.
Okay, a couple of follow-up questions for you there, Etienne, based on what you just talked about. Number one is the $35 billion. What's the split between active and passive?
That's a great question. And actually, where last year we had seen active slowly catching up, obviously it's a much smaller portion of the total market. You know, most of the assets in the ETF space remain in the passively managed type format. So we're talking about market cap weighted products. Those are actually, you know, doing really well in the year. So I think it was sort of by nature of how investors, once we had, you know, this drawdown I was talking about earlier, looking for a way to rebalance and get exposure to the market without necessarily saying, I want to take a specific bet or a style bet on the market. So definitely you know, close to 75%, if not a little bit more, have gone into passively managed mandates so far this year.
Okay. So when you look at the Fidelity Canada lineup, though, I think we just passed a bit of a milestone recently, did we not?
Yes, we did. We actually hit $2 billion in assets under management. So we were, you know, last December, we became the fastest asset manager to hit $1 billion. And then in less than a year, we were able to get to $2 billion. So thank you all for your support, for those who participated in that. We're happy with the results. And, you know, we're ready for next year where we can maybe, you know, climb into the top 10 in terms of AUM. So exciting things to come.
Great to hear. Okay, so why don't we dig into the topic at hand, which is international and investing international with our ETF lineup. Just overall, the flows have been quite strong recently. What's the reasons behind that?
Yeah, absolutely. I highlighted that one. I wanted to get back to it. Obviously, I was spending a bit of time on other points, but you know, that has been one of the emerging trends over the last couple of months, and actually since the beginning of the year. Because here, you know, the way that we break it down at Fidelity, we actually split international and global. Because global mandates usually have, you know, 40 to 50 or even more in certain cases of U.S. exposure. But, you know, if we actually look just on a pure international basis, so that includes emerging markets, it includes, you know, Asia Pacific, Europe, et cetera, it's actually been a really, really strong, you know, it garnered a lot of flows. And I think there are really a few reasons for that. The outright first thing that we can look at, and this is just from a market perspective, we're talking about a much cheaper market. Since March, we've had a wide divergence of performance from various sectors, regions, styles. And what we've seen is that obviously right now where we stand, this is as of October 31st. So, you know, it's changed slightly over the last month, but not a ton. IFI markets, so international developed markets, are actually trading at a wide discount to the U.S. and also Canada. So, you know, I think the investors' appetite for something that, you know, obviously has been trailing in terms of performance. As we saw a slow rotation begin in November, where November 9th, you had the biggest rotation in terms of style, where momentum sold off and everything that's been kind of the, you know, reopening or what falls now into the value bucket, dividend stocks, those rebounded well. And the exposure, or if you want, our index, is actually tilted toward the factors. So in the most recent drawdowns, it's outperformed. And then when we have that little rotation at the beginning of November, was outperforming. So for the month as a whole, you know, international markets outperformed the U.S., which was the first time in a little while where we've seen that. So there's an appetite there, I think. And it's likely going to continue as we go forward, because there is also that diversification aspect that we kind of neglected over the past 3 to 5, even I'd say 10 years, as returns have been, generally speaking, much lower in that region. You know, we know historically speaking, adding international will help reduce our volatility or increase our Sharpe just from a diversification standpoint. But, you know, often we tend to look at returns as the key driver there, not so much the volatility. So, you know, going all in on North America, or specifically the U.S., because Canada has been, you know, even bigger struggle on that front. You know, if we're invested in the S&P 500, we would have done much better than investing in MSCI IFI, for example. Now, that being said, when we do include it into an ACWI, for example, which combines both, so a global index, we are able to reduce our volatility. So I think if we have a better return profile going forward, this strategy will definitely pay dividends, I guess, you know, as we have sort of some of this reflation cycle, or basically an index that's more diversified from a style standpoint, I'd say.
Okay, thank you. A couple of follow-up questions there. We actually got one from the audience that I'll just jump in and ask. And they were asking about the ETF flows. Is there any way to distinguish between flows that are coming in from advisors, from investors, and for that matter, institutional flows?
Unfortunately, we do not have a methodology for that. This is just, you know, pure flows data that comes from Bloomberg, and that includes basically any creation or redemption that's made on the ETF. So it's very hard for us to split it, you know, which part of the, you know, which type of investors are pulling the weight. Unfortunately, I don't really have a clear answer for that. But I'd say definitely on the retail side, it's been a very strong component. Especially, like I said, during a rebalancing. So as a tool to enter the market very rapidly, to get a certain exposure really quickly. And also to if you were to move say to cash. So when we had a lot of investors who became a lot more conservative on the retail side. So there's also these new types of products in the ETF world called high interest savings ETFs. Those have garnered a lot of flows, you know, in the beginning of the year. Obviously, we're seeing that getting deployed into the market now as, you know, there's more, a bit more optimism around, you know, entering this COVID-19 environment. You know, we have news on positive news on a vaccine. So we're seeing outflows there, but that's been a really strong component that's been used by, you know, retail investors. So, you know, the broad picture, I'd say, is that pretty much everyone's participated. To what extent, I'm not too sure.
Okay, thanks for those comments.
I'm sorry if I didn't answer that perfectly, but you know, that's what I can give right now.
Yeah, safe to assume though, it's obviously when you look at the pension plans that are out there and you know, all the portfolio managers that use ETFs, it's probably quite large, I would imagine.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, valuations of Europe, Asia, and the Far East. What would be the best valuation currently in those three regions?
That's actually quite interesting, right? Because when we look at the S&P 500, we're talking about one country, TSX, one country, whereas the IFI, you know, there's more than 20 geographies that encompasses this type of index. So if we break it down a little bit more granular, I actually took a look at this yesterday, is that, you know, there's some parts that are, that, you know, compared to other regions in that space are more fairly priced. Some are definitely more attractive. One that stands out is definitely the UK. So we're talking about, you know, 14.4 times forward earnings. Japan is on the other side. So it's a little bit more expensive with a close to 18 times forward price to earnings. While if we look at Europe as a whole, so Greater Europe, we're talking developed Europe, also emerging Europe, which is kind of, you know, Eastern Europe and those smaller countries, we're talking about 16.9 times. So there's definitely some divergences there. But you know, I think the ideal thing here is that you want a broader perspective. Making a call on one certain specific international economy is one especially hard to do given the types of, you know, products available. But it also leads to, you know, obviously taking on some bets. And I don't think in the environment that we're in right now, taking on massive bets. And this is something that we also hear from our macro team, you know, whether that's, Urien, which I'm sure many of you have listened to through Fidelity Connects, also says, you know, maybe having some type of barbell approach from, you know, obviously a sector region, but also a style standpoint makes sense going forward. But yeah, there is definitely some divergence there. To give some perspective, EM is actually more expensive than the UK right now. So that's, you know, once again, goes to show how many opportunities there are in Europe right now. And, you know, we haven't even touched on the aspect of the, you know, cheaper US dollar, which was likely, you know, according to our macro team, likely going to continue in the next coming months, so short term, medium term, which will likely benefit especially emerging market economies, but also some European economies. So I guess that's the thesis for international. But if we, I guess, transition, and I may be stealing your thunder here a little bit, Gord, but you know, the reason why we're here is also to talk about what are some of the ways we can invest internationally, because obviously, yes, like we said, it helps diversification. There seems to be some value proposition there, but how do we do it? You know, it's been extremely tough to do so. So we understand this domestic bias that we have as Canadian investors, where we tend to focus on North America because it's closer to home. We understand it better. And if we look at, you know, what's out there in terms of products to use, I'd say the most common strategy that I see from investors and advisors in Canada is either going with an actively managed fund or a passive index like the MSCI IFI in an ETF form. And looking at, you know, say the 10-year of all funds outperforming this broad benchmark, that's only 25% that have managed to outperform. And that's without considering that the index itself has been, you know, a dog over the past 10 years. So it's been a difficult thing to do. We feel there are some great ways to invest internationally because we've identified some not inefficiencies, but some things that stood out to tell us that. So not only is it hard to beat that benchmark, we actually feel that the MSCI IFI has some inefficiencies embedded in it. And there's some, you know, problems with investing on a pure passive basis for the international space. And really the it stems from a very, very low rate environment, which obviously, if we go back 10 years in Europe, European banking crisis, we had, you know, Portugal, Italy, Greece, Spain, entering, you know, potential defaults on some government bonds. There's a lot of volatility, and it caused the European Central Bank to lower interest rates substantially. We went from close to 4% to below 1% for the almost the entirety of the curve, and now we're even talking in negative rates. And this is a theme that's obviously been developing over multiple years. But that's also led to certain spaces of that index to perform very well and some to be left out. Now, when I say that, you know, if you're buying the whole international space with a passive product like the MSCI IFI, you know, replicated ETF, you're buying 903 equities that have a very diverse investment profile. And what we found is that in this environment, stocks that, so I guess I'll use the term right now because we'll get to it eventually, but is avoiding zombie companies. And this is something I'm sure many of you have heard of recently, is that low rates have only increased the number of firms that are able to survive due to the cheap access to capital that they have, not necessarily by strong earnings growth or their ability to reinvest at a higher rate. So it's created a huge divergence between companies that have strong balance sheets, are able to generate a lot of free cash flow, and those companies that are basically on in survival mode, but are still a large part of that index.
Back to, you know, from a standpoint of flows into the industry, and when you look at this space, what are the biggest selling effectively ETFs in this space currently that you've kind of highlighted?
Yeah, it's the passive stuff. It's the, you know, if I use some, you know, the two bigger players in Canada for ETFs are BMO and iShares. So they both have their own version of the MSCI IFI index. ZEA is the ticker for BMO, and XEF would be the one for iShares. Those are the two big heavyweights, and it's invested in this index, which we feel, once again, that there might be some cracks, I guess, in the foundation where we don't necessarily have this problem in the U.S. If you think of the S&P 500, you're buying a passive S&P 500 product, there are some embedded inclusion criteria that you are taking on, which is somewhat of what we call a quality screen. So if you think about Tesla, you know, that announcement that it's going to be added to the S&P 500, huge news, it's the biggest inclusion that we've ever had. Well, it took some time. And the reason why is, first of all, there are volume criteria, you know, trading criteria, so it has to be very liquid. But the other thing that S&P 500 considers is you need to have positive trailing 12-month earnings and the last quarter earnings to be positive as well. That is not something that's embedded into an index like the MSCI IFI, where it's solely based on market cap and liquidity. So you're not basically screening out for companies that are not profitable.
The actual IFI index is composed of 899 equities. So some of these zombie companies that you're talking about, effectively these ETFs, those two tickers you mentioned, are like the Walking Dead ETFs, to use a term of
TV
show today.
Yeah, exactly. They're Walking Dead. I mean, it's crazy to think, because if you look at the underlying numbers, you'd think it'd be, you know, 10, 15 companies. And this is actually something for those of you that have, you know, are interested in this type of stuff. We heard a lot about this when MSCI was working around a Chinese equity passive, basically an index, where people were saying, well, tons of these companies are not necessarily shell companies, but, you know, they're publicized as a huge industrial, you know, production company, and you get there and it's like a small shop. Well, that was kind of the little, you know, grain of salt that got me thinking, that saying there's got to be these companies that are there that are not necessarily, you know, meeting expectations, that have an investment profile that might not be as attractive over the long term. And, well, like I said, interest rates have only exacerbated this. So, you know, we can actually see in numbers that this shows up. This is obviously theoretical, but there are practical, there's practical proof that this is actually the case. The percentage of unprofitable companies that find themselves in a product like ZEA, which is no bashing on BMO at all. This is just, you know, we're replicating an index that exists out there. So it's more on the structure of that. There's 16.7% of companies that have not turned a profit over the past 12 months. And if we look at some other metrics like the profit margin or return on equity, we're able to, with a product like the Fidelity International High Quality Mandate, which we haven't really talked about yet, we're able to solve some of these inefficiencies by targeting, I guess, the cream of the crop in the index. And, you know, historically, we've gotten a much more attractive risk return profile by investing in these companies that are, you know, perennial compounders, best in class in terms of their industry peers, and just have a great type of investment profile. If we do believe that stocks follow earnings, obviously, which doesn't mean that, you know, the companies that aren't profitable are necessarily bad. They're obviously, this is a situation where a lot of companies did have negative profits over the short term. But this has been the case for a little while, and it's jumped to 17% this year, but it was at close to 10% before COVID-19. So this is I guess this is the lay of the land that we have right now, where if we are looking to invest internationally, but, you know, find those companies or and sectors that tend to do well in this type of environment where there's low economic growth, there's low inflation, well, these companies are able to grow regardless of that environment. And that's really what we're trying to focus on here or invest in, obviously. But, these are some of the key metrics. There's multiple others that we could point to, and I think highlights the case for what we call high quality companies.
Okay, thanks for those comments. And in terms of the FCIQ, how many holdings are in that compared to the 899 would be in those passively managed ETFs?
Yeah, so we target 100 stocks, which are rebalanced on a semi-annual basis. So this is what we would call a smart beta product or factor product. It is rebalanced systematically in the sense that, this is a model that is programmed to run according to certain criteria that are established by a team of quant analysts, but also a team of fundamental analysts, which say, you know, if we want this type of exposure, these are the variables that we need to use to identify these stocks. And those variables, I won't go into details in this because it is definitely very technical, but we actually screen for three key variables for this factor, which is the free cash flow margin. So we want to look more granular than pure earnings, just obviously avoid as many tax loopholes as we can. We also use the return on invested capital, which considers debt unlike return on equity. And lastly, and I think most importantly, the standard deviation of earnings per share. So we also want companies that throughout a market cycle are going to be relatively steady compared to their peers. Because obviously, if we're going internationally, you know, there might be some, like I said, country risk, sector risk and things like that. But here we're trying to find those companies that have been really steady over the past 5 years. So we're looking at standard deviation of EPS over the past 5 years. And that's really what investors were looking for during COVID-19, is that I want to be comfortable with the stocks that I hold. I want to know that in the next 12, 24, 60 months down the road, they're still going to be able to turn a profit and have, be able to sell their goods and services and be, a solid company versus their peers. So I think there was a flight to safety or, more stable companies, definitely on the international space, especially. So, that's a bit of the quality factor there. Once again, 100 stocks. And that's the framework that we have for all of our factors as well, because we obviously do have the others in the space, like value, low volatility, dividend, among others. But really, the quality factors really shine. And unless we have this massive, massive rotation where, if you see interest rates rising substantially in Europe, maybe there will be an eventual rotation to value and dividend mandates. I think in the short and medium term, it's very hard to see, even with the great positive news we saw from a vaccine standpoint, which actually today were the first doses of vaccines being handed out in the UK, which is a great day, I think, great positive news.
Yeah, they're calling it V-Day in the UK right now. Building off of the old way of describing the end of World War II and that type of thing. Just quickly checking in from a standpoint of the flows into FCIQ and total assets in that ETF.
Yeah, so it's been our most popular mandate other than our, global unconstrained fixed income mandate called the Global Core Plus. It's actually garnered close to 250 to 300 million flows. I'm not sure the exact number, but it's definitely been our most popular option. And it's actually, so I think the momentum really started to kick in, around May, where we saw some bank models including it into their platforms. Not to name names, but that was really a positive turn where this was became a core holding into the international sleeve, I guess, for those discretionary accounts. And then we saw following that up with advisor interest and also just it was pure investor interest as well. So I think it's definitely been a success story, and we're very confident in its profile going forward. So definitely want to keep an eye on.
Great. As you know, we've got a huge lineup of actively managed international mutual funds. So we got a question that came in from the audience. How do active ETFs and active mutual funds complement each other?
That's a great question. And I guess the case that we're making here isn't just for, you know, ETFs. And what we're trying to achieve is to highlight some of the potential inefficiencies of the pure passive product, which has no consideration for anything else than market cap in a sense. An active manager that has a specific style. So we have some great managers here at Fidelity. If I could take one, for example, the International Growth Fund managed by Jed Weiss, which has a little bit of a, you know, obviously it says it in the name, a little bit of a growthier focus. You know, our quality mandate tends to fall in line with that a little bit. Now, if we look at another mandate like International Concentrated Equity managed by Patrice Quirion, another great manager, which is a bit more right now tilted, I think, towards, you know, value and cyclicals, would be a very, very good complement to a strategy like International High Quality. Just because of the, first of all, sector exposures, you know, the market cap exposures as well. So we will tend to be more mid to large cap, where there is obviously flexibility on that standpoint. I think it just really has to come down to diversification. You don't want a smart beta product that acts like your act, or that tries to mimic what your active manager is trying to accomplish. So if you're more of a value tilted active manager if you hold a fund of a value tilted active manager on the international side, well, do not buy a value or a dividend type international mandate, consider quality. Flip side, if you've got a growthier mandate, you know, maybe you want to use those smart beta products like value and dividend. So it's all about balance. And I think that's really the key message here, is that this should be a part of a larger composition of, you know, a few holdings internationally to diversify from a style standpoint, because it will allow you to have a much, you know, much more stable beta. It's going to, you know, be better on the in terms of downside, and then, you know, obviously still be there for the upside, which is also a key thing for this mandate in particular, the high quality, which is very good on the downside as well.
Great. Thanks for that. We're almost out of time, but I'll just close by saying, anybody's interested in getting more information on this, ATN's written a white paper. Don't worry, it's not 30 pages long. It's a nice, concise, 3 pages long white paper that ATN has authored. Secondly, ATN, you host a podcast, ETF Exchange Podcast, that you can access through fidelity.ca or wherever you access your podcast. So ATN, great job. Thanks very much for joining us today. Really appreciated your insight and thoughts.
Thank you for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. For more information on future live webcasts, please visit fidelity.ca. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.